I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Jolie Brislin, Regional Director of the Anti-Defamation League, or ADL, Desert Region, and Alyssa Knave-Worth, co-chair for ADL's upcoming Walk Against Hate. Jolie and Alyssa, thank you both so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
We're so excited.
So what exactly is ADL?
So ADL is the leading anti-hate organization in the world. We've been around since 1913, and our mission is to stop the defamation of the Jewish people and secure justice and fair treatment for all. We know that you can't fight one form of hate unless you're combating all forms of hate. And so ADL every day is working with our strategic partners and really looking at innovation partnerships to drive that impact within our community throughout the state of Nevada and nationally.
And how exactly do you put into place an anti-hate agenda?
Well, an anti-hate agenda really has to take a whole of society approach. So we have to be working with our elected officials and our community partners to be able to combat anti-Semitism and hate. And we know that hate is learned and with education can be unlearned. And so we work very closely with schools around the state on our No Place for Hate program, which is an anti-bias initiative that really tries to work on creating a climate of inclusion within schools.
Nice. Okay. So, Alyssa, what's the upcoming Walk Against Hate all about?
The Walk Against Hate is an ADL event that brings the community together to walk in support of equality and inclusion. Proceeds from the walk benefit a variety of ADL's initiatives. They can include establishing coalitions of respect, the ADL's work with law enforcement, and its award-winning No Place for Hate program in K-12 schools throughout Nevada, which unfortunately are increasingly needed as anti-Semitism, racism, and bigotry are on the rise. For years, the event has brought together families, friends, colleagues, teammates, and community groups, among others, to speak out and mobilize against bias and bigotry of all kinds.
So what exactly is involved in the No Place for Hate program that's in place in K-12 schools?
So No Place for Hate is an anti-bias initiative that we have individual schools sign up, and they are able to do programs and work with our education director as well to find ways to bring people together, to create conversation, and to really help to uplift the students on being the best advocates for their own community.
Nice. Okay. Now, what can people expect if they take part in the Walk Against Hate?
Well, it's not just a walk. It's really an opportunity for all of us to move as a community towards a future without anti-Semitism, racism, and bigotry. And the walk is, you know, it's an exciting day. It's going to be at the Aviators Ballpark. And it's really a symbolic walk as we join together and celebrate all cultures that make up the Nevada community and the world that we live in. So folks will walk around the interior of the ballpark a number of times. We're looking for a collective number of steps as we take a step towards a world without hate.
Oh, okay. That's cool. I like the symbolism of that.
Yeah.
All right. So it takes place at the Aviators Las Vegas Ballpark. When exactly is it happening?
The walk is September 29th. The doors open at 8:30 in the morning for check-in and walk-in registration, and the program commences at 10 a.m. Folks can learn more about it at walkagainsthate.org/LVWalkAgainstHate, or you can Google it through the Nevada ADL website as well.
Okay, and how long does it last?
It's approximately a 90-minute experience. Again, this is not, you know, your average 5K. It's really meant to be a collective gathering of community. As we walk around symbolically working against hate, there's going to be a number of cultural performances, everything from, you know, a high school marching band to a mariachi band and other surprise performances. In the past, folks throughout the community have participated, including a number of our athletic teams. And really, it's just, you know, like a 90-minute celebration of love.
That's awesome. What kind of people would you like to see come out? Is this for all ages?
This is for all ages. It's for the entire community. And it's really an opportunity to be doing something positive together. So often we've seen this increase of tension and bigotry and hate that's been filling. And so this is an opportunity, no matter your religion, your background, for you to be able to come together and do something positive in Las Vegas to show that Las Vegas is no place for hate. And so we're looking for the entire community of every age to come out. And like Alyssa said, this is not going to be an intense 5K walk. This is going to be really an experience to be able to come together, do something positive, and be exposed to different cultures.
Okay. What's the one thing that you would like listeners to know about hate and the positive difference that we could have in the future?
You know, if we come together and we have conversations and we get to know each other, we are going to be able to affect change in such a positive way, because you can't hate somebody once you know their story. And so coming together and standing Nevada strong and Las Vegas strong against hate in all its forms will make us a better community.
Awesome. Now, obviously, coming together and taking those steps together physically and metaphorically is one way to work towards that positive change. But what can people do on a day-to-day basis in order to better understand each other and start to eradicate that hate?
That's a great question. One of the biggest things we can do is we can be educated. We can learn about, you know, different cultures and religions and so on and so forth. But when we see hate start to brew and permeate, like, we can stand up against it. We can say that this is not acceptable, and we can stand up and be allies to one another. And that will make us stronger. And once we're able to stand up for each other, we are going to see that, you know, again, you can't hate someone once you know their story. We're going to be able to come together and be much more cohesive.
Okay. Now, are there opportunities to volunteer or get involved with ADL outside of the Walk Against Hate?
So ADL, we always want people to come and get involved with us. We want people to learn how to be allies and be educated. And so we have a lot of information. If you go to our website, adl.org, you can always call our office as well, and we can get more information. If you're interested in volunteering on the walk day of course, we would love to have your support. But it's really going to be a wonderful day and an opportunity to come together. We're very thankful for all of our sponsors, our premier sponsor of Wynn Resorts, Caesars Entertainment, Station Casino, Wells Fargo, Vegas Golden Knights Foundation, Rockstar, and Channel 13 for being great supporters and sponsors of this event and making this available to all people within Las Vegas.
Nice. Okay. So ADL.org is the main website for ADL, the Anti-Defamation League. Now let's give once again where people can go if they would like to sign up to take part in the ADL Walk Against Hate.
So the website is walkagainsthate.org/LVWalkAgainstHate.
Perfect. Okay. So once again, walkagainsthate.org/LVWalkAgainstHate. That's the website for the ADL Walk Against Hate that's coming up on Sunday, September 29th. Doors at 8:30. Program starts at 10 a.m. And that's happening at Las Vegas Ballpark where the Aviators play. walkagainsthate.org/LVWalkAgainstHate. And we've been speaking today with Jolie Brislin. She's the regional director of the ADL Desert Region, and also Alyssa Knave-Worth, who's co-chair for ADL's upcoming Walk Against Hate. And Jolie and Alyssa, I want to thank you both so much for being here and sharing more about what your organization stands for, what you're doing in the community, the difference that you're trying to make, the positive impact that you're trying to make, and also about how community members can come out and take part in the upcoming Walk Against Hate. So thank you so much for sharing today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. We really appreciate you. Thank you again. And we hope you will join us in taking a million steps against hate in Nevada.
Young or old, black or white, or anything in between. From employees to entrepreneurs, doctors to detectives, some things define us and set us apart, but there's one thing that binds us. Before anything, we are one thing. Born to be Americans, proud to be Americans. Our United States are our united fates. Know your Constitution.
Unity, it's an American thing. From AmericanThing.org.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Robert Lerman, Institute Fellow in the Center on Labor, Human Services, and Population at the Urban Institute. Robert, thank you so much for being here today.
Happy to be here.
So what exactly is the Urban Institute?
It's a social policy think tank that was started in 1968 when Lyndon Johnson passed the Great Society. There was a belief that we needed to study what was going on, evaluate. And since then, urban has grown, social policy research has grown, and we cover all kinds of issues from income and benefits, tax policy, labor policy, urban policy, housing, mortgage finance, and including criminal justice issues.
Yeah. Okay. So speaking of criminal justice issues, what are the strengths and weaknesses of the current recruitment process for police officers?
Well, the main problem is cost and effectiveness. First of all, you have to recruit people who might become officers, and then there's a long vetting process before they're admitted into a police academy. Once they're in the academy, you're paying them during the academy, and after the academy, they have very little on-the-ground training. So they only have perhaps maybe 8 to 10 weeks of field training before they become full police officers. So it's costly and it doesn't provide the kind of long-term on-the-ground work-based learning that other options do, such as the police apprenticeship.
Okay, so what has the Urban Institute's recent research revealed about the potential benefits of police apprenticeships?
Well, we find that young people who enter these apprenticeships can learn a lot over the 3-year apprenticeship period, but also contribute a lot. They engage in tasks that you'd have to pay someone else for, and they do it at a lower cost. And they have a much longer period of learning by doing, learning on patrols, all the other functions of police officers. Number one. Number two, it's easier to recruit because you're recruiting people in late high school or just after high school. And the vetting period can be shorter because people are younger and they haven't had a real long lifespan to look at. So I would say the main benefit is that you end up with an individual that you've looked at over a 3-year period. That individual has engaged in all the different tasks from following the evidence pattern, dealing with courts, a whole variety of things police officers have to deal with. And they have a lot more experience on the ground. They've seen a lot more situations emerge during their apprenticeship than the standard officer.
Okay, so, I mean, normal apprenticeships and internships have a lot of value because it allows someone to learn on the job while they're still young. And, you know, it's kind of like a win-win scenario for both parties. But police work is very dangerous. So are we taking kids who aren't fully trained as police officers and throwing them into dangerous situations?
No, they're doing other tasks. You know, they're handling the fingerprinting desk. They're dealing with fleet logistics, keeping the vehicles serviced, moving them to the right places. They're dealing with the mail work. They're dealing with a variety of things like having an extra pair of hands. They do have some period of learning on patrols, but they're not doing the arrests. And so they're not doing the dangerous components that police officers may have to face. But they see those components and they observe how good officers handle these situations so that when they become full officers, they're well prepared.
Yeah. Now, when you talk about vetting, what would an apprenticeship program reveal about how potential candidates may or may not fit in the critical role of police officer?
Well, their reliability, you know, are they showing up every day and undertaking the tasks they're assigned effectively? Are they getting in trouble in some other venue, perhaps? Do they use drugs? And how do they behave in encounters as they help policemen on patrol? So those would be some of the things that you'd look at. They can be watched over a 3-year period which is a lot longer than the on-the-job learning of someone who just comes out of a police academy.
Yeah, for sure. So do you have any examples of where this type of police apprenticeship program was valuable and successful?
Yes, my co-author was a police apprentice in Fairfax County, Virginia, and it's very successful there, albeit on still a small scale. Baltimore County has had a police apprenticeship for quite a while, but it isn't widespread. And that's, to me, an opportunity because departments can deal with their recruitment issues. They can recruit from people in their own communities and do it in a very cost-effective way. So they can actually save money by going this route, even though it's a longer period. It's a 3-year period rather than, let's say, an 8-month period. But the costs are much lower because these police apprentices are doing lots of work during their apprenticeship.
Okay, so where can people go if they want to find out more, first of all, about the Urban Institute or the potential of police apprenticeships?
Well, for Urban Institute, they can simply go to www.urban.org. And for our police apprentice paper, they can go to Robert Lerman, L-E-R-M-A-N, Urban and Police Apprenticeship. And they'll find this paper and lots of references to other work.
Okay, perfect. So once again, that website for the Urban Institute is simply urban.org. Urban.org, that's the Urban Institute, which has been around since 1968. And if you want to find out more about the paper on police apprenticeships that we've been talking about, just Google Robert Lerman, Urban Police Apprenticeships. Lerman is L-E-R-M-A-N. And of course, we've been speaking with Robert Lerman today. He's an Institute Fellow in the Center on Labor, Human Services, and Population at the Urban Institute. And Robert, definitely a lot to think about here. Definitely some potential solutions for police divisions across the country, things that they could think about implementing. And as you mentioned, it's already been proven. So sounds like a great model.
Yeah, I hope mayors and heads of police departments and city councils take a look at this option. I think they would find it both saves money and it improves quality.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for your time today, Robert. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I'm a wife and the mother of 2 kids. And when I get to work in the precinct house and put on my uniform, I can tell you, as a police officer, we're building partnerships. This should be happening everywhere. So the police should be reaching out to this community. And this community should reach out to the police. That's the way to make this a safer place.
Start the conversation and help stop crime. To learn the 5 things you can do, go to ncpc.org/preventviolentcrime. A message from the National Crime Prevention Council and the Bureau of Justice Assistance.
This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Abigail Sapote, Senior Advisor to the Commissioner of the Social Security Administration, or SSA. With identity theft scams at an all-time high, the SSA wants us all to know the facts about how to safeguard our Social Security numbers and cards. Abigail, thank you so much for being here today.
Heather, thank you so much for having me. Really excited to talk to Las Vegas listeners today.
So it seems like we're always providing our Social Security numbers for something. When do we actually need to provide the full SSN?
Sure. That's a really great question. So a Social Security number is, of course, a 9-digit number that's unique to you. And you might need this number when you file taxes, when you start a job, or when you claim government benefits.
Okay. And when do we need to use the actual card?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Listen, one of the things that we'd like to remind folks, especially as you mentioned earlier, we'd like folks to keep their Social Security card safe. And the best place that they can have that Social Security card is at home in a safe place, not in a wallet or carrying it around, right? So we do share with folks that often just knowing that 9-digit number is enough. Of course, when you are starting a job, when you're getting that passport, when you're claiming government benefits, that is when you need your physical Social Security card. But for other reasons, we always ask folks to request why someone is requesting that 9-digit number and figuring out if it's actually necessary, number one, to give out the Social Security number and or if it's necessary to even bring that Social Security card with them.
Okay, perfect. So you mentioned keeping the card at home, but what's the best way to protect their identity from being stolen?
Sure. If someone does take a look at their annual credit report and finds that there are some discrepancies, we do tell folks to report that information right away to the Federal Trade Commission at identitytheft.gov. We then ask folks to go through our replacement process. Folks can go to ssa.gov/number-card, and they can start that application online, and they might have to come in and bring some documents to the local office to complete the application. But again, keeping that card safe at home will prevent you from having to go through this process.
So that's the process to get a new card after the identity theft is reported to identitytheft.gov?
Correct, Heather. And I do want to share that this is a replacement card. People are going to keep their 9 Social Security digits, you know, for their lifetime. So this will be a replacement process, which, you know, we do like to share with folks that we have made it a whole lot easier to go through that replacement process, whether, you know, unfortunately, they might have lost that card and might have been a victim of identity theft or for other good reasons, right? So folks might be requesting a replacement card if they've just gotten married and are expecting to change their name, or if they finally gotten the opportunity to become a naturalized citizen, they can actually go through their naturalization application. We have a really great partnership with U.S. Immigration Services. So that Social Security card, after you're seeking a replacement for any of those reasons, will be at your doorstep in your mailbox 14 days after you request it.
So if we happen to lose our card or it gets stolen, we can get a replacement card that's the same as before, but a new card. Or if we happen to change our immigration status, our name or anything like that, we can also get a replacement card. But in all cases, that 9-digit number stays with us for life.
That's exactly right.
Now, you mentioned some different scenarios where we might request a replacement Social Security card. What documents specifically would be required in those instances? For example, a name change due to marriage, an immigration status change, name change due to immigration, any of those types of things.
Sure. So let me list them off in these different scenarios, right? So if someone has just recently gotten married, which congratulations, the best place, again, for you to figure out which documents you need, want to share that website, ssa.gov/number-card. For individuals who have just gotten married, we do request that they wait about 30 days after the date of marriage to request that replacement card. This is the time that's usually needed for the state to update their records, and then they can go through that application process online. Again, if for whatever reason they need to bring any required documents to the local office, they would either need to bring in a state ID or state driver's license and a U.S. birth certificate or U.S. passport. And of course, if they're getting married, if they need to come in, that marriage certificate. So that's one scenario. The other scenario, again, for a newly naturalized citizen, which I think is another really great congratulations if this applies to you. So through the application for the naturalization process, people can elect to update their card online and they don't have to do anything anymore. We get all the information from U.S. Immigration Services and then we get to process your updated Social Security card and it'll arrive directly in the mail 14 days after naturalizing.
Okay. And just to clarify, what documents would we need if the card is lost or stolen, but no information has changed?
If no information has changed, folks can usually do that online without having to present documents if they're eligible. So again, ssa.gov/number-card. However, if you do need to come into a local office to present those documents, you would need to bring a state ID or driver's license and a birth certificate or a U.S. passport.
Okay. Now, when you're talking about going into a location, what services are available in Nevada, for example, for getting a new card?
Yeah. So for Nevada, for getting a new card, you probably have heard me say this a couple of times. We ask folks to start that process online because usually it's faster than having to come into a field office. So you can start that process online at ssa.gov/number-card. Folks can complete the application process online, or they would start the application process online and then receive an appointment so that they can bring in those required documents to their local office to complete the application if it's required.
And I think it's always recommended to make an appointment, right? Not just walk in.
That's correct. And especially for a Social Security card, folks know Social Security as a government agency that provides retirement benefits, disability benefits, et cetera. But we also provide Social Security numbers to about 17 million people all over the country. And that's why we're making it easier to do this process online, ssa.gov/number-card. Once you fill out that application process online, and if you are requested to come into the local office, you'll be given that information. So that'll be your appointment to come in and provide that documentation to a local office. But yes, we do ask folks to go through that process so that you don't have to wait at a field office, as you know, folks are there for really important reasons, especially getting those Social Security benefits that they want to claim.
Yeah, absolutely. So how can listeners find out more about the topic of Social Security cards, how to replace their card, or again, how to report identity theft?
So we ask folks to go first to our website, ssa.gov/number-card, to find out more information about getting a replacement card and going through that online process if they need to. However, if someone is a victim of identity theft, we do ask them to report a stolen Social Security number to the Federal Trade Commission at identitytheft.gov. After you've done that, then we ask that you go through that replacement process with us. And finally, wait by your mailbox. The really great part about doing this online process is that once you're done, you just get to sit back and wait for the agency to do the work for you, and you will have your Social Security number 14 days in your mailbox.
Perfect. Okay. So the main website for the Social Security Administration, ssa.gov, but if you're looking for information on your Social Security card, getting a replacement card, getting a new card with new information, if you've changed your information through marriage, through divorce, whether you're a new citizen, all of that happens at ssa.gov/number-card, ssa.gov/number-card. And if, unfortunately, against all odds, your identity has been stolen, report that identity theft. Easy to remember website, identitytheft.gov. That's the Federal Trade Commission, but specifically the website, identitytheft.gov. And we've been speaking today with Abigail Sapote. She's a senior advisor to the Commissioner of the Social Security Administration. And Abigail, just amazing information you've been providing today. I think, you know, a lot of people don't know about the process, don't know what to do with the card, don't know they shouldn't be carrying it around in their wallet and when they need to actually be giving out that number. So extremely valuable information you've shared today. And thank you so much for your time.
Of course, Heather. Thank you so much for having me today.
I just got a text asking me to approve a bank transfer I didn't make. I bet you get messages like this too. So much of our lives are online today, from email to banking and everything in between. To make sure my information was protected, I checked out CISA's Secure Our World website for simple steps to stay safe online. Now I know how to protect myself from scammers, and you can learn too. Go to CISA at cisa.gov/secureourworld.
This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Robin Growley, Head of Consumer Deposits at Bank of America. As the school year gets into full swing, there's one lesson that's always valuable for both students and new graduates, and that's brushing up on smart money management habits. Robin, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Heather.
So what's the current financial situation for members of Gen Z?
You know, when we think about our Gen Z, they are really entering kind of the workforce for the first time. They're really trying to figure out their finances and what their financial goals are and what that journey looks like to get to their goals. So it's a really critical time for this generation.
So they're new into the adult world. What are some practical steps that Gen Z can take to achieve financial independence from their parents and go out on their own?
Yeah, it's a really big question, right? So financial independence, I always like to think about as starting with savings. You know, our Gen Zers who are beginning, they can start this journey with just a few dollars, right? So they can save a few dollars a week, and then they can create larger savings goals from there. I think one of the most important things they can do early on is to set up a separate savings account, and that's where they can store their funds. That will really help them avoid the temptation to overspend, and they'll be able to watch those funds grow over time. And then in addition, you know, we have to remember that many of these Gen Zers, they're going to be earning a salary for the first time. So there can be that temptation to spend freely, but it's important, you know, to understand this is the point at which they're beginning their financial foundation. So they really do need to live kind of call it at or below their means. And they can do that by really focusing in on, you know, savings or paying down maybe student loans rather than accumulating new debt. And they also need to think about things such as not spending, you know, every dollar they make in terms of going out. Maybe they can cut back on going out or not buying that latte every day. That'll help them on their saving journey as well.
Yeah, for sure. Now, for the money that they earn and don't put into savings or paying off debt, what are some good ways that they can manage that money that they might be earning for the first time?
Oh, yeah. Well, budgeting is one of the most important tools to help our Gen Zers save money and make progress towards those financial goals. I always like to say, especially, you know, when you're starting out, like, let's just keep it simple when you think about your budget. So I use the 50-30-20 budgeting rule, and that's where you take 50% of your after-tax income, and that's to cover really your needs. So think about, like, your rent, your utilities. Those are the basics. Those are the things that you absolutely must have, you need. Then 30% should go to the wants. So this is the dining out, the entertainment, you know, going out with the friends. And then 20% should be put into savings. And I think, you know, once our Gen Zs get better at creating that budget and sticking to it, then they're going to become even more confident in making other financial decisions as well as making that financial independence from their parents.
Yeah, okay. Now, besides the money coming in and going out, of course, there's credit. So there's loans in their future, maybe car loans, mortgages, there's credit cards. So what are some responsible credit habits that people can use for building long-term financial stability?
Yeah, you know, when we think about credit, one of the most important elements there is really building a good credit score, because having that good credit score will make it easier for our Gen Zers to rent that apartment, to get that auto loan. So the good credit score is kind of a foundational component. You know, when we hear a lot around credit cards, and we get a lot of questions from our clients around credit cards, and when credit cards are used wisely, they really can be an effective way to manage the spending as well as develop a solid credit history. But what's very important to understand is, you know, if you're the Gen Z or out there or any of your other listeners, when you use your credit card, it's important to pay that balance off on time and in full each month. And, you know, there are instances where you may carry a balance from month to month, but if you do, you really need to focus in on paying more than just that minimum payment. And especially as you pay on time, that's going to help build your credit score.
Yeah, absolutely. So what kind of financial tools and educational resources are available to help students and new grads, as well as the rest of us, to manage finances more efficiently?
Yeah, you know, one of my favorite savings tools is really around automatic savings. And what that means is being able to set up an automatic transfer from your checking account to your savings account. There's no minimum to do this, right? So whether it's $5 a week or $20 a week, doesn't matter. But really getting into the habit of having funds transferred automatically from your checking account to your savings account, that's going to help you build that buffer in your savings account. And guess what? It's not putting anything else on your to-do list because it's automatic for you. At Bank of America, we also have other programs such as Keep the Change. And that's, you know, as you're out there, you're using your debit card to transact, we will take and round up that debit card purchase to the nearest dollar. And then we transfer the change from your checking account to your savings account. And then lastly, we also have a financial education platform, Better Money Habits. And this is where you can get free guidance on budgeting and saving, paying down debt, investing. So it's a really nice way to learn more about your finances, especially as you're planning for that longer term financial journey.
Nice. So where can listeners go if they'd like to get more information about healthy financial habits, including the educational Better Money Habits that you just mentioned?
Sure. They can go to bettermoneyhabits.com or bankofamerica.com.
Perfect. So bankofamerica.com is, of course, the main website for Bank of America. That's bankofamerica.com. And if you want to find out more about financial education, you want to tap into some financial tools and educational resources, bettermoneyhabits.com is the website to go to, bettermoneyhabits.com. And we've been speaking today with Robin Growley. She's the head of consumer deposits at Bank of America. And Robin, as always, you have such amazing tips, you know, short, simple, easy to remember, and really valuable tips for all of us, and especially for the students and new grads who are looking forward to a strong financial future. So thank you so much for sharing today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Heather.
When a student lacks basic needs like food, clothing, and learning materials, attending school can be a challenge.
And that can make it impossible to thrive.
At Communities in Schools, we address this issue by ensuring that students have everything they need to re-engage in learning,
access to technology and school supplies,
and even emotional support.
By bringing communities of support to students, we're achieving equitable learning conditions.
And that's what Communities in Schools is all about.
Learn more at communitiesinschools.org.
Welcome to our Odyssey conversation about the economy maxed out, surviving or thriving in turbulent times. And it's true, there are people doing both right now. For some, this economy is just fine or even terrific. For others, it most certainly is not. I'm Doug Sovereign of KCBS News Radio in San Francisco. And to talk about where we are economically and how we got here, we're joined by my KCBS colleague, our business reporter, Jason Brooks, as well as his counterpart from WBBM Radio in Chicago, Rob Hart. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So the perception among many Americans is that the economy is not great. Groceries cost a lot more. Gas prices are higher than they'd like. Interest rates remain high. On the other hand, you know, the stock market's been hitting all-time highs. Inflation has cooled. Unemployment remains relatively low. Consumer confidence is up. Let's start with you, Rob. How would you characterize where we are right now in terms of this economy?
Well, this has been a head-spinning couple of years for everybody in how they perceive the economy, because 4 years ago around this time, maybe 4.5 years ago around this time, March or April of 2020, there were mass layoffs. There were a lot of people who were out of work, and those who saw, at the same time, though, you had a lot of people who maybe had the best year of their lives from a business perspective, because they worked for an industry that all of a sudden was very essential as we're trying to live this life in isolation during COVID-19. I had a friend who worked for Instacart, and while everybody else was talking about the possibility of extended unemployment because Instacart was delivering groceries to people's homes, they were doing very well. So you have the initial COVID shutdown and trying to manage your way through that, and then the economy comes roaring back with vaccines in 2021. And then with that economy roaring back and everybody going on vacation and spending up all that pandemic relief money you may have received, inflation takes off. And then interest rates go up. And you come out of this 4 years later, you may have a job, you may be making more money than you did in 2019, but you feel like you're falling behind because the price of everything has gone up.
Exactly. Jason, what can you add to that?
Well, it's very interesting because, as Rob mentioned, we saw a lot of stimulus money come into the economy and emergency moves after the COVID outbreak. And we saw the Fed cut interest rates down to zero at the time. That actually propelled a lot of people into the housing market as home sales took off, as mortgage rates fell. We also saw a massive wave of refinancing from existing homeowners who managed to lock in interest rates below 3%. I mean, that's something that was unheard of as far as a mortgage rate goes in history. We never saw mortgage rates that low. So that did benefit a lot of people in the pocketbook for a couple of years. The job market was strong, unemployment historically low mortgage rates. That enabled people for a couple of years to do very well. But as Rob also mentioned, we've seen inflation continuously rise. It's been slowing down, but still, inflation is up. It may be down for some areas like food and gas, but when you look at insurance, it's skyrocketed. Mm. We're looking at auto insurance gains of 20% month year over year, every month this year, and home insurance. That's a whole other ball of wax that people are dealing with, especially in areas that are affected by natural disasters, the wildfires here in California. We've seen a lot of people lose their home insurance. They can't find anybody that's willing to insure them. These are costs that have continued to rise, and it's been a real struggle for a lot of people. And now we're seeing the unemployment rate start to rise. It's still historically low at 4.3%, but that's the highest it's been in 2.5 years as layoffs have begun to pick up. And we're seeing more people lose confidence in the labor market as a result of that. And that's squeezing people, at least if not in their pocketbook at the moment. It's certainly doing it in a mental way as they start to prepare for the future.
Right. So there's a lot of components to unpack there. So yeah, we all know inflation went up a lot after the pandemic hit, and then the federal government took steps to address the recession and pulled us out. And so in many ways, we are much better off than we were 4 years ago when the economy was just reeling. But as you say, people are paying more for home insurance, car insurance. They want to pay less for milk and eggs and bread, but prices aren't really going to come down, are they? Right. And we actually don't want them to come down, economically speaking, do we, Rob?
Right. If the prices have gone up over 20% since 2019, but if you want prices to go down over 20% and take us back to where we were in 2019, you don't want to open that particular Pandora's box. But we find ourselves in a period of readjustment. This may be similar to the 1980s or the early 1950s, where we're in both periods of time in which there was inflation. Of course, the inflation of the 70s is well documented. And of course, inflation coming out of World War II in the late 1940s as the American economy regained its peacetime footing. And prices and salaries and life readjusted. And this may be the very beginning of that readjustment period, but just as how people look nostalgically on the price of a box of potato chips in 1970, you're already seeing nostalgia for the price of a Chipotle bowl in 2018.
So Jason, you mentioned unemployment, and it's remained, you know, historically low. We've had very massive job creation over the last few years, but we have seen these revised job reports lately that say, you know, wait a second, maybe the labor outlook isn't as rosy as we thought. Well, what's going out there on there, and what do we think the outlook is for the near future?
And that is interesting. We did see the federal government pull more than 800,000 jobs out of 12 months worth of jobs reports up through this past March. So certainly not seeing the job growth that was expected at the time, although wage growth has been solid. That's been a key factor in at least attempting to keep up with inflation. The wage growth of the past few years has been much stronger than it had been in previous years. But the labor market is the absolute key, because even with inflation, as long as you've got a job, you could pay your rent, you could pay your mortgage, your car notes, and put gas in the car or charge it up, whatever you may be doing. But if you lose your job, it's a different ball of wax. And the labor market remains critical, because as long as people have jobs, they can meet this high inflation that they've been dealing with. However, we have been seeing an increasing number of layoffs, in particular in the tech sector. We're about 250,000 tech jobs that were cut out of the economy last year. Not quite on that pace this year, but still about 150,000 so far this year. And then most of these people are not showing up in the unemployment numbers. These are folks that have gotten severance from their jobs. They were making a lot of money. They didn't need to go to the unemployment line. So it's not really being reflected in the overall job numbers. Now, as that severance runs out, if those people have not gotten another job, say in AI, as the tech sector is reallocating where it wants to put workers, they might have to go to the unemployment line. And we could see the unemployment rate rise even more. If we see people struggle to pay their mortgages, we'll see foreclosure rates go up. Foreclosures are at historic lows right now. There were moratoriums put on foreclosures after the pandemic to help people get through that time, and they've still remained very low as the job market has been strong. But if we do see significant weakness in the labor market, that will put more pressure on the housing market and an overall pressure on the economy as well.
Yeah, talking about the housing market, I mean, one of the measures of how the economy is faring is whether people can buy homes, if they can afford it. And there's so much focus on the Federal Reserve and interest rates. And I mean, 7%, historically, that's not very high, but by the last 10, 15 years, it is high. What is the outlook for home affordability? Do we think those rates, are they going to start to come down as the Fed starts to cut rates this year, Rob?
They are going to come down. I mean, they will fall as the Fed cuts interest rates. But once again, you have, as Jason pointed out, a number of people either refied into a 2% mortgage in 2020 or purchased a home at a 2% mortgage in 2020. And they are not very inclined to leave or walk away from that particular financial arrangement. I mean, getting a mortgage at 2% in 2020 was probably the greatest inflation-fighting tool that households could achieve going forward. So you will have lower mortgage rates, but the question is, does the inventory exist? Will people move out of their home and possibly walk away from that 2% mortgage and purchase maybe a smaller home or even a larger home at 5 or 6%? And that is why you have the housing market totally locked up. But this also brings up a very good point that Jason talked about as far as the tech layoffs are concerned, and that is a lot of our life up to 2020 or up to 2022, as a matter of fact, we were very used to a low interest rate environment. And I think I was kind of flippant back then saying that we're going to jack interest rates all the way back to where they were in the 90s. But for a lot of people, the 90s were a long time ago, and they don't remember what that was like. And a lot of people were very used to having their lives subsidized in ways small and large by low interest rates. And when interest rates went up, a lot of the tech companies that provided these services at low cost to you because they wanted to, because they were being evaluated on growth and not profitability, they had to make some money. And as a result, they either had to raise prices or shut down.
And wow. To dovetail on what Rob is talking about, a couple more points about housing affordability and getting people into homes. New home construction, that's key. Home builders have it busy this year, although that has pulled back in recent months due to high interest rates and the struggle to find buyers that can afford current prices. And the other one, which I mentioned earlier, with foreclosures. Foreclosures, all bad, and you don't want to see anybody go through them. Foreclosures have helped put inventory into the housing market and bring prices down. And that's something we have not seen for the past 4 years because foreclosures are at historic lows. And that's anticipated to rise as unemployment levels rise. That will add extra inventory into the market and likely bring prices down. Prices continue to rise. The S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller report just came out, and home prices in June hit another record high. They're growing a little slower each month from the past year, but they're still growing. So not a whole lot of affordability relief for home buyers out there. Of course, that also depends on the zip code and the market you're talking about. But most markets are seeing price gains out there. And a lot of markets in the Great Lakes and in the Northeast that had not seen any growth for several years, they are seeing bigger price growth because people are looking for places where they could simply afford to live.
Yeah, and one of the biggest drivers of economic growth is always people spending money, consumer spending, and that has remained really healthy for a while. And in fact, consumer confidence seems to be improving. So why is that so important? And why do you think people keep spending so much money if so many say they can't make ends meet? Rob, you want to tackle that one?
I think because they can and because they want to. I think we're a few years removed from trying to get all of that COVID-related wanderlust out and living your best life because you couldn't do so in 2020. But on the housing affordability side of the equation, if you have a low mortgage from 2020, you have a little extra spending money. And with the run-up in housing prices, you're also sitting on top of a lot more equity than you thought you did before. So you have the opportunity to take some of that equity out and continue spending if you want to, whether on home improvements or a vacation. But I think we're starting to see a little bit of cracks in the consumer. They're not willing to spend as much money as they used to. They're now looking for deals today. So maybe some of the air is coming out of that particular balloon. But consumer spending, powered the economy over a lot of speed bumps, especially in 2022.
A number of retailers have been coming out with their earnings reports also, and they have been mentioning that. Abercrombie and Fitch are talking about a challenging consumer environment. Walmart and Target have touched upon this, even though they've been pulling in a lot of money. Sales have been big, but as Rob mentioned, it's a lot of discount-focused purchasing out there. Discretionary items are in focus as they choose between whether or not they want a new TV or an appliance. Consumers are being choosier with their spending. We've seen massive travel over the past year, 2 years, when people could travel again after COVID. That is starting to pull back a little bit, with the airlines seeing slower travel numbers in the coming months. So consumers are beginning to adjust. They have run through that COVID relief money, and savings accounts have been depleted in many cases as people have been spending more on big travel plans. Also of note, Home Depot and Lowe's, they say that while people are doing home improvement projects, they're not doing the big ones. They're not putting in new kitchens or bathrooms. They're kind of reining back on what they're doing for home improvement just because of the high costs involved and also the home equity lines of credit. You want to take out that home equity, but it's going to come with a higher interest rate attached to it.
All right. Thank you for the great conversation. Jason Brooks of KCBS, thanks for being with us.
It's been fun.
And Rob Hart, WBBM, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Two veteran reporters on the business world, thanks for joining us. And I'm Doug Sovereign from Odyssey All News Station KCBS in San Francisco.
Retirement can be scary, but only if you're not prepared. That's why AARP created thisispretirement.org. Because unless you've already retired, you're in pretirement and you still have time to plan. Learn about retirement savings options, potential tax breaks, and how you can build savings over time. Visit thisispretirement.org for free resources to help you customize your action plan and feel the retirement fear disappear. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include this Monday, September 9th at 8 p.m., benefiting the Unforgettables Foundation, and Monday, September 23rd at 8 p.m., benefiting the St. Rose Dominican Health Foundation. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. Aid for AIDS of Nevada, or AFAN, is holding the 38th annual Black and White Party in partnership with Clark County's Love, Live, Undetectable Equals Untransmittable campaign on Saturday, September 14th, starting at 8 p.m. at the Chaos Nightclub inside Palms Casino Resort, with VIP cocktail hours starting at 7 p.m. Get your tickets or find out more at afanlv.org. That's afanlv.org. Boys and Girls Clubs of Southern Nevada are holding the 11th annual Sneaker Ball on Thursday, September 19th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Donald W. Reynolds Clubhouse, 2980 Robindale Road in Henderson. Find out more or get your tickets at bgcsnv.org. That stands for Boys and Girls Clubs of Southern Nevada, bgcsnv.org. Safe Nest is hosting their Pathways to Hope brunch fundraiser on Saturday, September 21st at 10 a.m. at Red Rock Casino Resort and Spa. And their Run for Hope 5K and 1 mile walk are happening Sunday, October 13th at 8 a.m. at Wayne Bunker Park. Find out more, get tickets to the Pathways to Hope brunch, or register for the Run for Hope 5K at safenest.org. That's safenest.org. The Children's Heart Foundation's 6th annual Hearts for Charity fundraiser is happening Wednesday, September 25th at 11 a.m. at Four Seasons Hotel Las Vegas in the Acacia Ballroom. Get tickets or find out more at chfn.org. That stands for Children's Heart Foundation Nevada, chfn.org. The Las Vegas Natural History Museum's signature fundraising gala, the 2024 Dinosaur Ball, will be held on Saturday, September 28th from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Las Vegas Natural History Museum. Find out more or get your tickets at dinoball.org. That's dinoball.org. ADL's annual Walk Against Hate is happening on Sunday, September 29th, with doors at 8:30 a.m. and program at 10 a.m. at Las Vegas Ballpark. Register to walk or find out more at walkagainsthate.org/LVWalkAgainstHate. That's walkagainsthate.org/LVWalkAgainstHate. The Shade Trees Once Upon a Gala is happening Thursday, October 10th at 7 p.m. in the Zouk Nightclub at Resorts World Las Vegas. The poolside VIP Secret Garden Soiree gets underway at 5:30 p.m. Get your tickets or find out more at theshadetree.org. That's theshadetree.org. The Nevada chapter of the Bleeding Disorders Foundation is holding their annual Unite for Bleeding Disorders Walk on Saturday, October 12th, with opening ceremonies at 10 a.m. and the walk starting at 10:30, followed by a picnic lunch at Floydland Park. Find out the details or register to walk at uniteforbleedingdisorders.org. That's uniteforbleedingdisorders.org. The Just One Project is hosting the 4th annual Big Cup Golf Tournament on Thursday, October 17th at the Revere Golf Club. Find out more or sign up to play at thejustoneproject.org. That's thejustoneproject.org. And Communities in Schools of Nevada is holding their 14th annual Today for Tomorrow fundraiser on Saturday, October 19th at 6 p.m. at Fontainebleau, Las Vegas. Find out more at cisnevada.org/event/TFT24. That's cisnevada.org/event/TFT24.